I've just been informed that the chairperson is on his way. He's a bit late this morning. He was probably in Joburg or whatever. But we also come from our own constituencies, and we are not late. But temporarily asked me to chair and start the meeting. Once more, you're all welcomed, and we'll immediately, right away, start getting to our business of the day. I'm informed that this morning's presentation is Maritime Defense Program of the RSA. I don't know how to start. I don't know where, who's going to start talking to us. We know each other already, or one another. I don't think we need any further or any more introduction. I'll therefore hand over to whoever is supposed to give us the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. As you have already said, Chairperson, that I think we all know each other. We've been here quite a couple of times. I do think my delegation has been here, and it's known to the honourable member. I am here in my capacity as acting secretary for defence. She has sent her apology. She's out of the country, attending a SecDef. Attending a DEFCOM in China. So she really had wanted to be here, but could not be able to come because of the work there. Chairperson, we assumed that the program as it stands is an extension of the annual report as was previously presented here. I hope we assumed correctly. The presentations that will be here, that will be made today, will be mainly on emanating from the annual report itself. The program that we received informed us that we need to present today the landward defense program and the air and the maritime defense program. We have been directed to present on strategic objectives not achieved during the period under review, and also the achievements and challenges experienced during the same period. That will be our presentation today. The maritime will be presented by Admiral Totterberg, and then the landward defense will be presented by General Drost. We will start with the maritime. Admiral Totterberg.
Honourable Chair, honourable members of the Portfolio Committee on Defence and Military Veterans, members of the DOD, members of the press, thank you very much for this honour to present the Maritime Defence Program, of which we are extremely proud, to you today, in particular with the in relation to our performance during the 09-10 financial year. The aim of my briefing, therefore, is to brief your committee on the Maritime Defence Program of the RSA for 09-10. I would like to cover the following scope of presentation, just look at our mandate, our strategic objectives, and from there our missions. Where do we do this business? With what do we do? What are our achievements? What are our challenges? What is our performance against plan? And would like to come to a conclusion. Our mandate, sir, is certainly directed by what is contained in the constitution of our country. The South African Navy defends and protects the sovereignty and territorial integrity of the RSA by maintaining and providing prepared and supported maritime combat forces, services, and facilities. These are our strategic objectives: to defend and protect South Africa and its maritime zone by providing surface combat capabilities consisting of frigates, combat support, offshore patrol vehicles, inshore patrol vehicles, and a maritime reaction squadron to provide a subsurface combat capability of 3 submarines, providing 2 mine countermeasure systems in each annual operational cycle, and obviously also to provide an ongoing hydrographic survey capability and nautical charting organization. Navies generally have more than one role. In peak time of war, when everything else has failed, navies should be able to do war fighting. That's perhaps their primary purpose in life. However, we would hope that having that ability, in fact, leads to us having a deterrent, and that we would never get to war fighting. Strategic deterrence to us means that we must demonstrate the ability to defend the RSA when it is needed. We do this in terms of our war fighting with frigates, submarines, mine countermeasure vessels. We do our strategic deterrence certainly with submarines and frigates, but we also have a diplomatic role. I can tell you that this morning the SAS Drakensberg will be sailing from Montevideo, and she will be sailing to Buenos Aires across the River Plate, where she will go alongside tomorrow morning and the South African ambassador to Argentina is on board, and later this week, in fact on Saturday, an agreement, a bilateral agreement between our country and Argentina will be signed aboard the SAS Drakensberg. That certainly fits into the diplomatic role. At the same time, just in terms of strategic deterrence, I'd like to say that yesterday morning the submarine SAS Charlotte Mosteke left Montevideo for South Africa, and I hope that our submarine with her crew will be carried in your prayers as she crosses the South Atlantic coming back to South Africa. Should be here early in December. But we also have a what is known as a policing or constabulary role. This is primarily conducted by patrol vessels. We have a benign role, hydrographic survey is one of them, and then also, if needed, and we need to transport aid to another country, or we need to support our forces at sea, we need combat support and sea lift vessels. These are the tasks that any Navy should be capable of. Where do we do this? Just for interest sake, obviously this is our area of interest around here, and includes all our maritime zones. But as you can see, many of the shipping routes come around here, and more, with the problems being associated in the Gulf of Aden, the Suez Canal over there, and what is happening in the Gulf of Guinea, you will see that more and more ships will be coming around the Cape, and we will be going straight up to North America and UK and Europe. Therefore, once again, we would contend that the Cape of Good Hope is becoming more and more important to international shipping, and we need to ensure that that shipping has the ability for innocent passage. This is our ground. This is where the Army operates primarily. However, South Africa, as I've explained to this committee before, owns this real estate over here, over which we have rights and responsibilities. Those rights and responsibilities are executed and ensured by your Navy. I thought I'd put this slide on to indicate to you that more and more, and this is a slide that I've got from the United Nations, more and more we will notice that South Africa, in fact Africa, is becoming the hub from where drugs, in this case cocaine, is traveling from the east towards Africa or from South America to Africa and then being transported into Europe and North America. Fact of life. 60% of all human trafficking in the world happens through Africa. Toxic waste is being dumped over here. We have many examples of people in Africa suffering from these types of things. This is cocaine, this is heroin, the same picture. And just for interest sake, for those of you who don't know, that Mozambique has shown the largest increase in the trafficking of drugs in all countries in Africa. The question needs to be asked, where are those drugs going to? Can the people of Mozambique afford those drugs? And where are they going to? What do we do this with? Well, in terms of the 1998 review, option 1, approved force design, 4 corvettes, we can call them frigates, 6 strike craft, mine countermeasure, 8 ships, no offshore, inshore 2 patrol vessels, combat support vessel 1, strategic sealift and sustainment vessels not reflected in option 1, hydrographic survey vessel 1, and total ships and submarines, therefore 26. However, in our review, we are saying that in terms of submarines, 3 submarines meet the requirement. 4 frigates meet the requirement. And we are combining the survey combatants, mine countermeasures, and patrol vessels into one multi-mission type vessel, which is Project Biro, which has been, the Naval Staff Target has been approved by the Minister of Defence and Military Veterans last week. Where are we with respect to our force design? And in, I'm talking about 0910, age of ships, there they are. You can see in terms of the frigates and in terms of the surface combatants, the subsurface combatant submarines, in terms of age, they are really coming into their own now. But if we look at the Warrior Class offshore patrol vessel, 31, 27, 24 years, you can see that they've come to the end of their life.
I
hope
they
yes. River Class mine hunters, Unkamazen, Zunkurum, Shloti, 29 years old, ready to be put out to pasture. The inshore patrol vessels, they are, we call them our plastic boats, they're made of glass fiber, they've really come to their end. The combat support ship SS Drakensberg, during this year she did phase 1 of her life extension program, and phase 2 will be commenced at the end of next year. And then Protea, our workhorse, is 38 years old. Just for interest sake, we bought her in 1972. We paid 25 million rand for her at that time. Goodbye. Just in terms of, to give you context, if you buy a frigate today, it will probably be about 3 billion rand. If you buy a submarine today, about 2 billion rand. If you buy a patrol vessel, about 400 million rand. But the problem is that in terms of running costs, the total annual costs for a frigate would probably be about 133 million rand each, for a submarine 30.3, and for a patrol vessel about 32. Just to give context. So what are our achievements? First of all, we used last year, 19 in particular, to get ready for 2010 FIFA World Cup. And it would seem the country has already forgotten about the huge success of this event. But it was safe. Our harbors were clear. We investigated 1,267 contacts during that time by our divers. And that capacity was created during 0910. Not to forget the submarines, because the submarines will have me for breakfast. We fired for... Excuse me, Mr. Mayor. Bow to your previous qualifications. Consecutive successful exercise torpedo firing. Very, very successful with a wire-guided torpedo. We participated in 3 multinational exercises. Good Hope, Dolphino, and Dalboy. We participated in the inaugural Landlocked States Maritime Conference arranged by Botswana. Our Isibungu Youth Development Sailing Project is doing extremely well, not only nationally but internationally. I think the achievements are in our report. This is where we take youngsters from very disadvantaged backgrounds and they go and we teach them how to sail. And I want to tell you, if you ever want to see something good, this is something good. Children who don't have food or clothes who come down and we teach them how to sail, we give them food, we give them voluntary medical services, we give them clothing, and we send them overseas and they go and sail. They went to Egypt, they won certain championships, they went to Turkey, they went to Italy. These are our children, this is our future. We presented the Naval Coordination and Guidance of Shipping course to all FADC navies. We organized for the first time a submarine escape and rescue work group from NATO. Here in Cape Town, delegates from 23 countries came together and had a very good time. The Maritime Reaction Squadron revealed the new forward deployable base to the media and relevant DOD stakeholders in Saldana. This is a deployable facility that is contained in 33 containers and can be shipped railed anywhere you wanted, had a command and control, a living condition. It is really a deployable asset, and we used it to great effect during Kwele, which is World Cup 2010. We had an accommodation set up here in the Cape Town Harbour. We had a command and control centre in PE. We had our radio system in Pretoria. It worked extremely well. And then our reserves, we've increased the utilization of reserves to 61,000 mandates. In terms of the challenge, there is no doubt, and nobody can go away from this, that the Defence Force and the Navy, in this specific instance, that we are underfunded for the amount of vessels that we operate, we are underfunded for the levels of maintenance that we have to carry out, and for the amount of sea days that we have to spend at sea. Where does it reflect? It reflects obviously in the maintenance repair of our ships, in our system support contracts. We are doing more and more ourselves because we cannot afford everything to be contracted out. We have really consolidated our naval ordnance, and I must admit in certain cases depot stocks have been depleted, but we are balancing this off by looking at the readiness levels. Obviously, as explained last time, this will affect our levels of capability or readiness levels. However, we believe that we still meet all the requirements. In terms of performance indicators, there are they. They are contained in the book. I'm not sure whether there's going to be a question about Mantatisi. If there's a question about Mantatisi, then perhaps I should deal with it now, ma'am, as what do you call precursor operation. There are three issues. We have answered more questions about Mantatisi than any other force structure element in the South African Navy. This is a Type 209 submarine. There you are, from the side and from the top. It carries a number of batteries. In fact, that red portion is the battery. There are 240 cells in this battery. The batteries weigh just over 500 kilograms per cell, therefore there are 240 tons of ballast being carried at the bottom end of the submarine. Without batteries, apart from the fact that I can't drive the engine, that apart from, if the batteries are not in that submarine, I cannot put that submarine in the water, the submarine will turn turtle. It will capsize. There is the issue that's been reported widely in the press, over which we've been asked many questions. This is the junction box ashore. When the submarine comes alongside, we connect it to shore power. This is the junction box where somebody went and connected the wires the wrong way around because they were not marked properly. And in fact, that resulted in those fuses being blown on board, those trip switches being tripped, that specific amp meter having to be replaced, and subsequent to the Board of Inquiry, we marked them properly, we built a new training system for this, and we are under the opinion that this thing that happened to us will never happen again. The second issue. I think we've all heard that we bashed Mantatisi. That's the bash. During a very, very stormy day, we had to go to sea on a Friday morning. The entrance to the submarine basin is too small for this type of submarine with one screw. We did touch the key there. And you can see that the plane, this is called the aft plane, that's where the propeller sits, you can see the aft plane bent slightly upwards. We immediately took the submarine out of the water, we checked the watertight integrity, we checked the alignment of the shafts, etc., etc., etc. There was no further damage. The only damage was that specific little point that was bent upwards. That's the only thing that happened. Subsequently, we are now going to widen the entrance to the submarine then, so that there's more space. We have a plan in place to address this. The third issue is the issue of the submarine battery. We noted, this is, by the way, this is a battery cell, 500 and something kilograms. The battery cell, when you charge it, it develops hydrogen. Fact, the battery in your car does the same thing. However, there was an excessive, we measured the hydrogen, there was an excessive buildup of hydrogen within the battery. We involved the Institute for Maritime Technology, we involved Stellenbosch University, we got the Sunlight, which is the battery manufacturer in, we involved the Greek Navy, because the Greek Navy used exactly the same battery and had exactly the same problem, and the repair solution is there. There's a little hydrogen release valve, and now we release hydrogen as it is created into the submarine, and from there it is sucked out. When it's charging, remember, when it's charging, it generates hydrogen, but then I'm supposed to be on the surface or snorting. These batteries are now all within a battery hall ashore, and they go through charge, and we take the charge off, so we keep them going all the time. There are a number of these batteries that have been damaged and cannot be repaired and will have to be replaced. Sunlight, the battery manufacturers indicated to us that in the negotiations that we're in with at the moment, that some of these batteries will be replaced by them free of charge. I think these are all contained in the document. All our performance indicators, and then perhaps in conclusion, this is a small navy. It really operates on a very small budget. It has a very small amount of people. If I tell you that in 1987, good morning, Mr. Boyd. Honorable Chair, welcome. This is a small navy. In 1987, we operated for 15,000 people. We are now at 7,300 people. We use 60% of our money to pay for our people, and 40% of our money goes towards operating. That does not include the capital portion. We keep this balance going, because to pay 80% towards salaries and 20% towards operating would not work, and the other way too. We are extremely proud of our achievement. The stature of our Navy is recognized not only within the SADC. If we don't drive the Standing Maritime Committee, nobody else will. That includes the Sea Power for Africa Symposium, our initiative, which is presently stuck in Libya, but we are getting it unstuck. Within the AU, we make a huge contribution to the drawing up of a maritime security strategy for our country. Within the India-Brazil South Africa dialogue, we contribute. Within South America, in terms of UPTASU, the exercises, and potential defense participation between the two countries in them, possibly even committing to buying some of the Umkhonto missiles from our country. In Europe, 2 weeks ago, I gave a lecture in Italy. 43 nations applauded South Africa on its achievements. And obviously in the IMC, Indian Ocean Rim countries, we will be in 2012, we will be taking over the chair and we will be doing the conference in 2012 here in Cape Town. We believe that our Navy represents the people of South Africa, and that our Navy has really become the people of South Africa's Navy. Thank you very much.
Before I hand over to the chairperson, I realize he has just arrived. I want to thank Rear Admiral for a very difficult journey, Bernard Kettenberg. Thank you very much, Chief, for the presentation. This, to some of us, is a very difficult topic. I, for one, for example, I've never seen a submarine except on the surface, on the water, when it comes up and disappears and so on. Never mind getting into it. Even during the Second World War, when Germany was sort of specializing in submarines and sabotaging and shooting our ships, we were just, because all yesterday we couldn't see anything. But it's quite clear that South Africa has made great advances in terms of acquiring some of the equipment that we will need in order to defend our country. It's really heartening to hear from the Admiral that some of our young boys who've been roaming in the streets from so-called disadvantaged areas and people are today being recruited and given food in the Navy, trained, competing in other countries, and trying to make them good and better citizens for South Africa. We thank you for that. With that, I want to hand over to the chairperson. Perhaps he will then ask us to start asking questions if there are any. Thank you very much. Over to you, chairperson.
I really want to apologize. I thought the house line would do me good this morning, but it outmaneuvered me. It was not on time, so I had to get on the 7 o'clock flight. I really apologize. But I thank you for holding on for me, and with your comments, I would allow members of parliament to ask questions. Admiral, we always admire your responsibilities and the way you're conducting. Thank you very much. And thank you. Member.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I posed the questions from the Mantan Tishe, and there's still one of my questions outstanding. I didn't receive the answer for that. But coming back to that, I want to know from the Admiral, firstly, was it the first time that, with the docking, that the submarine now has been coupled with the box? When did it happen? I mean, was there a thorough investigation? Surely someone, there must have been maintenance or something, because quite clearly, because of the changes of the wires, somebody didn't know what he or she was doing. And the consequences were quite severe. That's the first thing. As far as the batteries are concerned, the problem as far as the hydrogen is concerned, now you said, I think it's the Greeks, they have similar situation and that similar problem. Now, why couldn't this problem been picked up much earlier and the solution been implemented? That's my second question. Thirdly, Chairperson, I want to know, how long is the Mantan Tishe out of operation now? And when? I don't know, I'm an infantryman. Do you refer to the ship as a she or a ye?
Sorry.
A what?
Sorry.
She, okay. When will she be at sea again? Thank you.
Honorable Premier.
Thank you, Chair. I have a couple of questions. Let me begin with the first order questions. Chair, deployment of our maritime forces is, at the end of the day, a political decision, and it's a decision taken by Cabinet. Now, obviously the question arises about the Navy's capability to deploy to Somalia. Now, if we were to deploy maritime forces to Somalia, that would be a political decision, and it would be a decision taken by the Cabinet. But my question to the Admiral is, in the event of a decision to deploy maritime forces on an anti-piracy mission to Somalia, is the Navy capable of such a mission? That's the first question. The second question, Admiral, you've mentioned Project BIRO. I wonder if you could just simply...
Sorry, Honourable Member. Given that the project is not in place, you see, so how much confidential is that, you see? can be also a tricky question. I wouldn't want them to enter into that field of divulging information that are related to certain and preparation. So it will be quite difficult. Well, or you do have a way of handling it. Okay, that's fine. But don't divulge any confidential matter. The national security of the country is standing. And we have to always protect anybody that deals with such matter. So take that sensitivity along in your answer.
Chair, I respect obviously your concerns about national security. I'd really just like the skeleton of Project Biro. What is it that we are procuring? Over what period will the project be implemented? The third issue comes to combat readiness. Now, I must compliment you, Admiral. I think your strategy of a preemptive strike was exactly the right strategy, and let's put the issues challenging our submarine flotilla on the table. On the submarines, there has been a lot of, or there have been many reports in the press about the fact that we have a submarine in, quote-unquote, the shed. Do the three problems that you have outlined account for the fact that that submarine is in the shed? And to build on the Honourable Groenewald's question, when do you anticipate it will be coming out of the shed and be put to sea? The second question on the submarine, you referred to the batteries. I was intrigued that you said that in order to develop your solution to the problem, you approached the Greek Navy, not the German Navy. Presumably, therefore, these batteries are batteries that are not used by the German batteries. Could you tell us a little bit more about the company Sunlight, where it's based and where these batteries come from, and why we would have purchased batteries that are used, for example, by the Greek Navy but not by the German Navy? Still on combat readiness, on the frigates, there have also been articles about a damaged engine on one of the frigates. The claim is always made that one of the frigates has a damaged engine and that cannot be repaired. Is that true? Could you brief us on that matter? Then, Chair, just finally two questions. The Admiral mentioned the question of total expenditure on people. I notice in one of the slides in the annual report on page 93 that the Navy has 402 surplus staff members and that the Navy is overstaffed. What is being done to rectify and right-size the South African Navy? My final question is related to the constabulary and policing role of the Navy. And Admiral, perhaps this is less, it's probably not a question that ought to be addressed to you, but to the Secretariat. I mean, we read in the annual report that the Navy has taken part in anti-poaching and coastal patrol activities during the previous financial year. But what is not reflected in the annual report is the actual outcomes achieved during those patrols. How many ships were interdicted? Were any individuals arrested? That detail is not reflected in the annual reports, and it's something that I would appeal to the Secretariat to look at. Across programs, what our Defence Force achieves is not reflected often. The outcomes that our Defence Force achieves are often not reflected in our annual report, and I believe that that's something that we need to look at going forward. Thank you.
I have an honourable member.
Thanks, Honourable Chair, and thanks so much, Rear Admiral Todeberg. I think you have presented an in-depth and highly informative presentation. On slide 5, bullet point 2, you are talking about annual operational second. Can the Admiral clarify what is it? And same slide, on hydrographical survey, I just want to know whether it's an ongoing exercise, how much does it cost per year, and whether it is well sufficiently budgeted for, or maybe you need more funds. Now, on the rights and responsibility of the Navy, of course, I want to know how many nautical miles of the coast does the Navy or the Republic of South Africa has sovereignty. Bullet point, slide 16, you are talking about gradual decrease in the number of people leaving the SA Navy. I want to know what caused the departure in the first place, and what measures have you taken to decrease this hemorrhage of personnel from the Navy? You talked about the disadvantaged people, disadvantaged children. Here we are talking about how many disadvantaged children, because figures may help us. And how long are they going to be in the Navy, or are they as permanent personnel, or at some point they are going to be released from the Navy? That is all. Thank you.
Thank you, dear.
I'd like to welcome the presentation by the leader. Mine is a question. How much is the cost of the batteries? The cost of the batteries. It seems that quite a lot of money, but how much is it? Thank you very much.
Any other honorable member? The one experience that you should be able to talk to us about is the success of the 2010. How did you integrate into that? And I mean, we have not had any bigger incidents. How much, has that helped in the posturing of the SNDF in the maritime side? How has it helped? As I've indicated earlier to you, we're quite pleased about your presentation, but try to confine and keep to the annual report as much as you can, and don't go into issues that have got security implications. On agreement with the department, it's always been that we are going to take issues that are related to the annual report most of the time, so that we don't venture into issues that are going to create. Yeah, I know David Coyne with his very nice combat readiness, but it isn't democratic, right? But give answers that are going to maintain what it is in the annual report. If members of the secretariat have some answers, they should also help in the answering of questions.
Yes.
You wanted to... Dr. Mlangi?
Just one question. I don't know whether it's relevant, Admiral. In the comeback, could be 20 years ago, when we were on Robben Island, we used to see a patrol fly, aeroplane, patrolling the sea, and so on and so forth. I don't know what its function was, whether its function, among other things, was or were to see what other ships are stranded in the ocean, or whether it was to detect if there are any enemies trying to attack us. I don't know if such patrol ships are still, aeroplanes are still doing that job. If this is irrelevant and is not part of the report, please don't answer that question.
You have the whole Navy to protect you on Robben Island.
Honorable Mayor.
Thank you, Chairperson.
again, let us applaud the department for a good presentation. On your slide 17, you speak about the underfunding that has impacted the CERT. And also you identify areas that have been affected. And thereafter, I did not hear you telling us whether this matter has been attended to, it has been resolved or not, because you are identifying very important matters which may result into your operations not being carried out properly. So can you tell us if whether this matter is being resolved, what methods are in place, if it's not, what do you think we should do?
Any member? I'll give over to the department to answer.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think Admiral Totterberg will continue to answer the questions, and where the Secretariat needs to supplement, they will do so.
If I may turn to Mantatisi. No, it was not the first time that we connected the submarine to the shore supply. It happens every time the submarine comes alongside, the engines get switched off, and you take the wires ashore and you connect them. So it's an ongoing. It happens every time you come alongside. It was properly investigated. A board of inquiry was convened, and a number of steps were identified on how to ensure that it will not happen again. Whether a person was held responsible or not, a person was held responsible. He was reprimanded. Because we need to understand that we're a force preparation organization. We take young people, and we then take these young people and we train them to the best of our ability. And if sometimes they make a mistake, then they must learn from it, but never make a mistake twice on board a submarine. So, yes, we've learned a lesson. We've implemented those lessons, whether that is training, marking, standard operating procedures, etc., etc. We've also put other engineering changes in, and we believe that that will solve the problem. However, I must indicate that there was no severe damage. Anybody who reports that there's severe damage, if you blow a fuse in your home, then in the old days you took it out and you put a cigarette paper in there to make it for a 6-inch nail. That's not the way it goes. But what I'm trying to say is it does happen from time to time. But there are fail mechanisms in between. There was no fire. The fuses protected the submarine. By blowing the fuse, it protected all the power supplies on board the submarine. In terms of the batteries, why were the batteries bought from Sunlight? South Africa specified a submarine. It didn't specify that it wanted Sunlight batteries. The Germans decided as part of the Part C contracts to the SDP, Strategic Defense Packages, that these specific batteries made in Greece meet the specifications of the South African Navy. They are not used by the German Navy because the German Navy does not operate 209 submarines. They are used by the Greek Navy because the Greek Navy operates 209 submarines. And the submarine manufacturer, Hargeisa, has a plant in Greece where they build similar submarines for Greece. So we collaborated. We, for example, we found some noise. We said to the Greek, we've heard some noise. Have you got the same problem? So there was a lot of collaboration with us on this to ensure that we get the best value for money. The most difficult question to answer is probably how long Mantatisi. What we've decided to do with Mantatisi, and she is in the shed, quite right, Manta TC is going to be the first submarine that will be doing a major overhaul in South Africa. We will not take it to Germany or Brazil or wherever to do a major overhaul. Major overhauls come at regular intervals, and in order for us to establish the capacity and the capability to be able to do a major overhaul on a submarine, we've said we'll take Manta TC whilst we've had the problem with the batteries, etc., etc. Let's use her to work out exactly what needs to be done when she comes to the major overhaul. The major overhaul is scheduled for the year 2012 and 2013, and by the end of 2013, Manta TC will be operational once again within the water. The question about Somalia, you quite correctly state that this is a very sensitive issue. It is a political issue. The question, however, is could the South African Navy participate in such an exercise? We believe that we are capable of participating in something such as Operation Atalanta, which is an EU operation, because Atalanta would assist us with the necessary logistics support, base support, intelligence, etc., 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 that we couldn't do on our own. However, it would be a very difficult situation to maintain a presence in Somali waters over an extended period of time. Because if you decide to send a frigate, you have to swap that frigate probably every 3 months and bring it back to South Africa, and you would have to rotate forces. Do we have those forces to rotate on a regular basis? I would contend at present it would be very difficult to in fact be able to do so. So for a short duration, a relatively short duration, 3 to 6 months, we would probably be able to maintain a presence in Somalia. I think we would be given sufficient warning, we would be ready to do so, and given the support that Atalanta would give us, I believe South African Navy could. However, there are implications, and I don't want to go too deeply into those implications. In terms of Project Biro, recognizing the words of the chair, the Honourable Chair, Project Biro, the Minister has announced, and it is covered in the back page of a James Defence Weekly, that Project Biro is a project to acquire 6 patrol vessels for the South African Navy in a multi-mission mode. Therefore, these patrol vessels will be able to do a number of tasks and therefore combine all of these tasks in one containerized, modular in design. And the South African Navy has announced and said that we would like these vessels to be built in South Africa in series and not in parallel. And we have had numerous inquiries from countries to the north of us who would like to share with us such a building program. I don't wish to, in this open forum, wish to name the countries, but there are countries who wish to build similar patrol vessels in South Africa, which would certainly assist our industry and would assist in putting one training system, one space lifecycle management system together. I think that's about all I would like to say about Biro. I think I've spoken about the submarine Manta TC, except to say that with the 2 submarines that we have in the water at the moment, we are meeting all and more of our force employment and force preparation expectations. We are getting better service out of the Type 209 submarine than we ever got before out of the old Daphne submarine on which the Honourable Member, Mr. Mainier, served a long time ago. Mr. Mainier. I must be quite honest. I need to blame my brother because I think my brother trained himself. I can't remember which submarine it was, but it was one of the old Daphnes, which are now museum pieces.
I've always been suspicious that you never entered into the submarine.
I think I've answered the question about the batteries, where they come from, etc. In terms of the frigates, I wanted to start off by saying this country got the best value for money ever when it bought these Mika Type 200 frigates from Germany. Never again will we get such a bargain. That's the first thing I want to say. They are brilliant at sea, they're capable, they've got long legs, they've got speed when you require them, the sensors work beautifully, and with a helicopter on board, I tell you, perfect ships for our type of coast. However, yes.
Admiral, don't be careful, Tatum Langen will be looking for legs in the ships.
I'll be very politically sensitive. In any case, there isn't...
What I want to see is the submarine.
No, you'll see it, sir. It makes it quite different.
Sir, I make a promise. I've made promises here before, and I've kept them, by the way. I will make sure that the Portfolio Committee of Defense can visit the submarine and that we will take them to sea. But please remember that some mariners, generally because they look through a periscope, they have periscope vision. They do not have 360 vision. They only see one target at a time. You see some mariners like that, sir. Here you go. Frigate! Sorry.
I know I'm not telling how white it is like this. Every day.
Okay, we know who my target is.
I'm sweating. Jimmy, are there lights on me or what? We have one, the starboard propulsion diesel on one of the frigates is broken. Water got ingress, one of the valves through the water exhaust let water in, salt water got into the engine and it broke the crankcase. In order to fix that specific engine, we have to take that specific engine out of the and replace it. We have the necessary money, we're in the process of ordering a new engine and a test bed. But in order for that engine to be removed from the frigate, we need to cut the hull. Therefore, I need to open up the ship on the side, take the engine up, and take it to the side. That's the way it's been designed to do. Now, obviously, you can understand that that's quite a major evolution, and that is planned for next year. For this year, due to Okrele and World Cup 2010, we decided that having one... remembering that the ship has two diesel engines and a water jet driven by a gas turbine, we decided that a gas turbine and a diesel was sufficient to operate on our own coast. We would not send her beyond that. That's being looked at. In terms of people expenditure, sir, we are not overstaffed. We're in fact understaffed. But the figures indicate that 400 people are not held against posts. It's a technicality where we had more MSD members in service, more youngsters in service than we had MSD posts on our structure at the time. And therefore it's a technicality. We are investing in these youngsters, and once they complete the MSD service, they are transferred to the core service system and then they go into proper posts. We are, however, fixing that problem. In terms of constabulary policing and the outcomes, how many vessels were interdicted, I do not have those figures here because we, in fact, what happens is that the vessel helicopter is handed over to CJ Ops who operates. But may I indicate that when we send a frigate to do this type of job, customs is on board, police is on board, sea fisheries is on board, police is on board, etc., etc., each looking after his or her segment of the policing. And specifically, we do this on, and I want to be careful, on a monthly basis. We now do official patrols with all these people on board, and it's it's turning more and more successful. During Okwele, a rather large number of vessels were interdicted, searched, etc., etc., even before that. I want to indicate that the helicopter in this regard gives us over-the-horizon capability with their infrared cameras. We can now get contacts far out to sea. Brilliant helicopter. In terms of slide 5, let me go back to slide 5. Three submarines and inch annual operating cycle measures indicate, like my car, a submarine goes through, or any vessel goes through, a series of maintenance periods. You have an operational period, then you have what is called a self-maintenance period of 2 weeks. An operational period, and then an assisted maintenance period of 3 weeks. An operational period, and then an annual docking and essential defects, about 6 weeks long. So you rotate your submarines through such a cycle. Every 5 to 6 years, you do a major overhaul. So every ship goes through, and that's why we call it an operational cycle. You will never, in real terms, in any navy, at any stage, will you get, even if America has 5 aircraft carriers, they will never have 5 aircraft carriers at sea at the same time. 1 or 2 will always be in some sort of maintenance refit schedule. In terms of the coastline, I must admit, I suppose this is called Alzheimer's. I should know, I think it's 2,985 kilometers of coastline. The problem is that it's not just coastline, it's sea behind it that we look after. First of all, the 12 miles, the 24 miles, the 200 nautical miles, and then the 350 nautical miles from the coast. As we get further away from the coastline, our rights and responsibilities diminish. Closer to the coastline, within the first 12 miles, all laws, and therefore it's really a policing task. But as we get further, it becomes less and less and less. The question was asked about the gradual decrease in the people leaving the Navy. We have a number of retention strategies, and I must admit, with the assistance of Dr. Mary Ledwaba, who's sitting here on my left, many of those strategies are starting to pay fruit. They consist of numerous initiatives. For example, I'm not joking, but there are push factors, things that we push people out of service, and then there are pull factors from outside. Before World Cup 2010, there were huge pull factors because electricians, electronics experts, etc. were needed for World Cup 2010. Now, suddenly, there's no requirement at the moment, so it has decreased. But we've done a lot ourselves. Submariners, and as I said, I'm not joking. Submariners like to be unique. We've made them unique. We've given them leather jackets. We've given them a specific submarine badge that identifies them as being submariners. We have given them watches, submarine watches. It's small money, but if it keeps the submariners, then we have succeeded, and we are starting to succeed in doing all these things internally. Also allowances, we've got some allowances through. Other allowances are still on the road. As I said, Dr. Mary Ledwaba is sitting there. She's assisting us greatly in getting these allowances through, and once they're through, we will keep more of the people. But it's starting to improve rapidly due to a number of reasons. In terms of the disadvantage, I want to say that the program, the Isi Vungu Vungu program, is a voluntary. It's not there, not in the employ of the Navy. It's a voluntary program by members of the Navy. It's sponsored. We don't use a cent of state money. We get sponsors, Mediterranean Shipping Company, Navy people, etc., who give up their own time. It stands on 4 legs. A mathematics and literacy program, a music literacy program, a seamanship program, and a sailing program. In the sailing program, we've got 128 people at the moment. In the music program, Soldana and Farmerstown, we've got about 120 people at the moment. We have people donating instruments for these children so that they can play. We've got a band of children playing in Soldana, beautiful music, with instruments that were donated in Germany. beautiful second-hand instruments, it works. However, I must admit for the MSDs, the Military Skills Developer, we take in on an annual basis around about 700, but we will have to shrink that slightly due to financial constraints. How much are these batteries? Somebody wanted to know how much they cost. Well, sir, one battery consisting of 480 cells would today cost me between 30 and 35 million rand. The success of 2010. I believe the success of 2010 was the will of the people of this country and the Defence Force and the police and all agencies working together towards one goal. We created this joint command and control center at Rennie in Pretoria, from where everything was coordinated, integrated. And that's what led to the success. Everybody wanting to be successful. We covered three ports, Durban, PE, Cape Town. We assisted the Air Force with some radar coverage. We had 30 of our people sitting on mountaintops with binoculars reporting to an Air Force station on flying objects that they may not have picked up. We had chemical, biological, radiological defense teams in Durban working with SAM. So it was totally integrated. Everybody cooperated. And I think if we can take Opkwele as an example for this country forward, then we are moving. There was a question about maritime patrol aircraft. The South African Air Force operates maritime patrol aircraft with us. We have a link with these aircraft. They exchange information with us. They tell us where fishing vessels are that we can't see. Remember, if you're on sea level, your horizon is about 10 nautical miles, but if you're in the air, your horizon is far away. So they have sensors on board, and with our helicopters, it is a team effort. Nothing is jointly done. The last question that was asked with respect to underfunding. I think we have scaled down in Durban. We have closed our reserve units. We have done a lot in order to become more affordable, and I think we have become more affordable. I think we are participating with the DoD in doing everything we can in order to develop a strategy that would become affordable while still meeting our mandate. And our mandate must be to protect the sovereignty and territorial integrity of our country. Thank you.
I think you left out a question on hydrographic survey.
I'm terribly sorry. A pet subject of mine, hydrographic survey. Hydrographic survey is a national obligation. South Africa is the signatory to the Safety of Life at Sea Convention. The articles in there give us our responsibility. We are a member since 1954 of the International Hydrographic Organization. In 1967, we signed the convention, and we have this responsibility. Not only because we need that information, not only because our submariners need that information when they dive, but in order to ensure that all merchant vessels operating on the coast of South Africa do so with up-to-date charts and navigational publications. Are they up to date? They are as up to date as they can be as technology changes. For example, 45% of the waters around South Africa have been surveyed by means which are non-electronic. It has to still be done with electronic means. We are slowly but surely getting there. We have another approved project called Project Hotel, which will replace SAS Percha in time to keep this hydrographic survey capability going. Thank you, sir.
Can you take the lap down so that you can speak to the next one? Honorable, any other member? Honorable Martinez. Those will be the last few members, then we go to the landlord. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, my question on the batteries, maybe the Admiral didn't understand my question correctly, but what I want to know, Admiral, the problem of the hydrogen buildup and the installation of a release valve. was this the first time it occurred? What I actually meant is, my logic tells me that if the Greece Navy is using these same batteries and everything, surely they must have had the problem before, and then they must have, for instance, installed the release valve. So why did we wait? Or maybe I'm wrong. Was it the first time that we had to deal with this problem? My second follow-up, Chairperson, is, if I understand the Admiral correctly, I understand it's operational time, shorter maintenance time, then we, operational time again, then the major overhaul. Now, if I understand it correctly, well, firstly, I asked how long has the Bantam Tishy been out of operation? That question has not been answered. But do I understand that such a major overhaul takes about 3-4 years? Is that what our submarines are going through? I just want clarity on that, Jefferson, and thank you for the thorough answer on the fuses and everything. Because it's quite clear that there is a problem as far as the training was concerned. But there are measures taken and to prevent that it happens again. I can just say to the Admiral, in the infantry we cannot afford such mistakes, because then some lives would have been taken. Thank you.
Can I keep...
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to come back to the issue, first of all, of the submarines and then on the frigates. Admiral, the submarine has obviously been in the shed for quite some time. Honourable Groenewald asked how long. You will presumably answer that question shortly. But what I'm driving at is, why was that submarine in the shed? Is the explanation confined to a battery problem, or are there other factors which may explain why that submarine was retained in a shed? Then, moving to the frigates, you've told us that one engine on one of the frigates is out of commission. And that occurred because of an incident. I'm not quite sure what that incident was, but there was a flooding incident on the vessel, which, and somehow seawater flooded into the engine. My question is, was there a board of inquiry into that incident? What were the main findings? Was disciplinary action or any action taken as a result of that board of inquiry? And also, what is the estimated cost now of replacing that engine? Because, as you say, it sounds like a fairly major evolution, which I assume will take place in South Africa. Thank you.
Any other members?
Can I possibly start with Mr. Manier's question about the frigate first? There was a technical investigation where engineers looked at the whole problem. And we need to remember here that we have quite a complex system whereby we exchange exhausts depending on the speed of operation. Therefore, at greater than certain speed, we go to underwater exhausts. Therefore, there are specific valves. The investigation, in short, found that there was a shortcoming in the one valve. We believe this to be a design shortcoming, but particular to the sea states that we operate in. It happened when the vessel was rolling excessively, and therefore the pressure changed as the exhaust went down. And there was water ingress through the exhaust into the engine, and damaged obviously the crankshaft of this engine, and whatever happened after that. This was properly investigated. All the other frigates were investigated for the same problem, and an engineering change was done in order to improve the closing of the valve under extreme conditions. That has been implemented, and we hope that that will be the last time that this happens. To replace the engine, a new engine will cost us 16 million rand. I would like to turn to the submarine in the shed and the other factors. It's not only the battery. There are a number of issues. One of them was the issue of lack of submarine trained personnel and the fact that I really only had two full crews for two submarines. And therefore, in order to ensure that I kept two submarines operational in order to train new crews, because as you will know, I need to go to sea in order to give people their task book training. We made a conscious decision, which I 100% supported, to rather not bring Matatisi back earlier, leave her where she is, and concentrate on the two in the water in order to create a bigger manpower pool sooner. So when I have created that manpower pool, I can shift them to Matatisi and get Matatisi going in terms of the major overall. May I also just say that in terms of the major overall, we are in the planning phase at the moment. Therefore, we are not physically working on her. We are in the planning phase with assistance from the hardware, the manufacturer, and other people in order to plan this very, very complex exercise of doing a major overhaul. We will then commence with this once we are ready, once we know the full extent of what the major overhaul will entail, we will commence. And at this stage, the prognosis is that by the end of 2013, she should be fully operational. And that's when we would like to take the next submarine out of the water in any case, and do her major overhaul. So it all ties in. And now, would like to turn to, once again, to the batteries and the hydrogen. The Greek Navy was building their submarines at approximately the same time as we were. We, in fact, discovered the problem before they did. We advised them of the problem, and they have implemented the same repair solution to this. I'm not clever enough to tell you why this was not picked up perhaps 2 years ago or 3 years or four years ago, but I can tell you the hydrogen buildup 4 years ago was not what we had now. Whether that is because the batteries need to be replaced in any case every 6 years, and whether they were coming towards the end of that recharging, you know, every time we recharge it gets more and more, I'm unable to give you that, honestly, that answer. All I can say to you is this was a new problem. Nobody had experienced it before. We experienced it, and we involved the Greek Navy and Sunlight in this process. How long has she been out of operation? I think it's about 3 years that she's been out of operation, if I'm not mistaken. I may be wrong, but I would like to respond in writing to that question. I will be able to tell you exactly, because she was the submarine who still participated in sinking the NATO task group around the coast of Africa. So I will have to come back to you on that one.
As long as you do that through the chairperson and the secretary, we'll be able to keep on our eye. Honorable members, can we thank the Admiral from Robben Island?
When are we going to the submarine?
Admiral, your submarines, when they are not sailing, when they are not in operation, say at night, you keep them under the water? You have answered my question. Thank you. You have answered my question.
Can I just for the sake of clarity, just say through your chair, the submarine goes to sea. It, in order to run its diesels to charge the batteries, it requires air. So it needs to either be on the surface or at 12 meters depth with a snort mask that sucks air from outside. If I go deeper than 12 meters, if I go 200, 250 meters or whatever, I run on batteries only. And then I have a limited time that I can stay under the water. Then I have to come up at some stage and snort air in again. When she's alongside in harbor, she will be on the surface.
Can you allow us to go to the next question? Welcome. What your family has been had, and give an opportunity to learn more. And then with anything from the secretary.
Okay. That's only to acknowledge or to acknowledge what the honourable member David Nini has said about the outcome. We will take a note of it and we will in future incorporate in our report.
I think that'll be good for the Navy and good for the department.
Can
we
go to
Yes, Chairperson, on the land watch, General Ross will do the presentation for us. Thank you.
Welcome, General.
Thank you very much, sir.
How are you?
Excellent, yourself.
Very, very excellent.
Very,
yeah. I wanted to check to every member of the land watch defense, and that's what General is going to be able to take us through. You ready?
Chairperson, can I don't want to interrupt the presentation. You were not here, but unfortunately I have a meeting with the commission, so I will leave in a couple of minutes. So if I stand up, just accept my apologies.
No, I know that.
You know that.
I just want to say thanks all the time to let everybody understand, but no, don't get into that now. Don't create your own thing. Don't become the media person there. My general, everything is in your capable hands. Sometimes our members do live up and down, not because they show disrespect, but because they've got some small commitment and serious commitment. But they have got great respect for your effort and everything that you do. Give it over to you. Young member of our committee. He looked very nice today. Honorable Mlambo, we always want to congratulate him for his performance. He's doing very well from that call. David Meni, can you leave the media now and start settling? General, we are yours. All here.
Thank you for the honor to present to you the landmark defense capability and what we have reported in the annual report there in line.
If you could just use your mic.
I would like to confirm my intention is to give you a broad overview with regard to the landmark defense program as well as the reported in the 09-010 report. The scope that we are going to address, we are going to look at an introduction, quick look at the strategic profile, challenges, expectations, realities, SA Army achievements, the systems type of approach, the SA Army budget allocations and broad challenges, focus areas, and summary. If I can start off and if I can introduce, I would like to show you a quote that was written way back in 1963, but it starts off by saying, "You may fly over land forever, you may bomb it, you may atomize it, you may pulverize it and wipe it clean of life. But if you desire to defend it, to protect it and to keep it for civilization, you must do this on the ground." way the Roman leaders did by putting men into the mud. I think that is very important. We must have, in our terms, we use the term, you must have boots on the ground to defend your country. So, from our side, land power side, I think what is important, firstly, is that land power is decisive, and land power will be decisive in Africa as well. It's totally different when you are an island and those type of things, an island country, but in South Africa's case, land power will be decisive, so that is important to us. Secondly, it is important that we follow a landward strategy. That does not mean that we exclude anything else. To be quite honest with you, we will just now come to it and you will see that land cannot work without the other services. Modern warfare is based on an integrated systems approach between all the services and the divisions. If we look at the South African Army profile, I think what is important there, I would like to start off with a mandate. And it says to provide combat ready forces for the pursuance of national defense and the prevention of war, fighting which to jointly and preferably multinationally, swiftly and decisively achieve national security goals. Now once again, here we will see the word jointly and preferably multinationally. So here we need the other services and the divisions, and multinationally, yes, we need other countries as well. Also,
yeah, no, Chairperson, I'm looking at the slide in my position, and I see that this slide that the general is presenting is restricted. Now I want to know whether his is not restricted.
No, I don't think so.
I know that there's been good discussions in how they sort out their presentations.
Yeah.
It might have been restricted before it came in front of you. But now, when he starts do presentation, he's the one who's giving you. So it's been photocopied from them.
You have the same slide that I have seen.
Which one is that one?
The one that he's going through now.
Yes.
That one?
Yes, I do. Or yours?
The one that says...
So you're referring to the word security?
Mm.
No, I...
Defense security.
Are you sure you've got...
It's no problem, sir. We can
no problem.
It. Yeah, we can get
it. I get the authority from them.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you to bring it to our attention.
Chairman Edward, I can continue. And then, secondly, collaboratively, promoting peace and stability both internally and externally in concurrence with international obligations. That is more focused on the warfighting capabilities of the army. And finally, to contribute to the development, upliftment of South Africa's people and the African continent in broad. If we have to summarize this mandate, we will say there's the defense part of the mandate. There's the security part of the mandate, and to a certain extent, there's the socio-economic part of the mandate as well. So that means that the SA Army must be able to contribute to national defense, it must be able to contribute to peace and stability and development and upliftment, and it must have equal capabilities to address all of these areas to a great extent. What is the vision of the SA Army? The vision of the Army is to be professional and dynamic. Now, to be professional is, if we can take it to small things, we must be disciplined, we must be on time, we must adhere to civil authority, all those type of things. Then very importantly, to my opinion, is this word a dynamic force as well. I think we live in dynamic or in a dynamic world, and what is important for the army is to be able to adjust itself to the changing circumstances as we progress and as we move into the future as well. So we must be flexible enough to adjust ourselves to what is required and what may be required in future. If we look at the mission of the SA Army, mission very short and sweet to the point, prepare, provide and sustain land forces for the employment by Chief of the National Defence Force and specifically by Chief of Joint Operations to whom we provide combat ready forces. So if we look at Chief of the Army strategic intent, where does he want to take this army in future? He says, the future SA Army is a combat ready component of a full spectrum capable And I will come back to the full spectrum just now. Joint, I said to you, it is important that we are capable to work with other services and divisions, that we have the capacity to send forces externally out of the country, and that we have the capability to maintain those forces over long periods, optimized for fighting in complex environments. And here, once again, if we look at complex environments from urban areas to rural areas, to areas where you have differences in the religion, all those type of things, so we must be able to operate in that environment in future as well. What is the objectives to be achieved? And I do not want to spend too much time on this. However, I think what is the importance of any army is to win. To win either the peace, the conflict, or the war. If we win the war, I think that's the easy one. The conflict is more difficult, but we send our helicopters to Mozambique to aid the Mozambicans. To win the peace, we build bridges in the Eastern Cape, that type of environment. However, we must contribute to the main objectives of the SANDF and the country by protecting the territorial integrity, contributing to peace and stability, protecting vital interests, defending the homeland, providing Chief of the National Defence Force with the reserve, development of Lieutenant, and all of these will then contribute to deterrence in the long run. I think what is important about this is that there are three concepts that will support the achievement of the objectives, and that is the capability to shift your forces to where they may be required, be it in Africa or wherever the case may be. Once again, to fight in complex type of environments, I just now explained to you as well. And then once again, to fight as a joint interagency and interdepartmental type of force as well. The strategic objectives there are summarized once again, and I'm not going to run through them again. If we look at the concepts, I think the three concepts that are of vital importance to us is joint, interagency, interdepartmental and multinational operations, expeditionary operations or operations where we can send our forces externally, and complex war fighting. If we look at joint operations, once again, very important, we must be able to operate with the Navy. We must be operate to integrate with the Air Force to optimize fighting power if required. And once again, this is the land component per se. If we look at the concept of expeditionary type of forces, this is an old map dating back to mid-2000 of Africa. And what we are saying here, this is just things that happened somewhere in Africa over that time. So it's irrelevant. If you take the map today, you will still find a lot of things happening in just in different environments. But South Africa must have the capability, and specifically the SA Army, to shift forces to where they may be required in Africa to contribute to peace and stability on the continent as well. If we look at complex war fighting, I think the only thing that I would like to say about complexity, and this is a subject totally something on its own, is here we will have to deal with threat complexity, yet human complexity. If you look at a book written by Rupert Smith, and he says war amongst the people is one of the most difficult types of war that you will have to encounter in future as well. Because how do you train your members to operate in this environment? Very difficult. Then physical complexity, and then information complexity, that is very important to us. If we look at the SA Army's future capabilities, what will the Army be capable of doing in the future? I think this is summarized by the following statement by General Kurulak. It says, at any one time, troops might be delivering humanitarian relief in one place, conducting peace support operations in another, counterinsurgency in another, and fighting combined arms battles against an armor formation in a fort. At any one place, they might be fighting house to house in a major urban battle one day, supporting the collection of forensic evidence the next day, and restoring electricity and running water the following day. So I think what we are seeing here is that we need a defense force that is well-trained, well-rounded off, and that needs a lot of capabilities to really be successful in future war. We're still not there yet, but we are building towards this part of the environment as well. So, what must the future SA Army, and I want to emphasize the future SA Army, focus on? They must focus on the total spectrum of conflict, from combat operations right through to humanitarian type of operations on the left-hand side of the conflict spectrum. So we must be able to execute it, and we must be able to thrive in all of those environments. And I think that per se is a mammoth task as well. If we look at the challenges currently, I think the biggest challenge for the SA Army in future is going to remain relevant and ready in future. We must look at today's army and today's challenges, tomorrow's challenges, and future challenges. And I think what we are saying here is we accept that the army is not going to get all the funds it will require in future. But if the allocation of resources is heightened as we move into the future, that is fine, and we can accept that. And that we will, once again, not receive all the funds that we require, we also can accept that, because government has its specific priorities in this regard as well. However, if funds decline and we do not get additional and sufficient funding, it may influence the SA Army in future as well. So it is vital, and we would like to link on with what the Navy has said as well. It is vital that the Army is funded the outputs that are expected from the SA Army. That is very important to us. If we look at the expectations from the SA Army, I think what is important here is there is a perceived capability of the SA Army. It's quite interesting when members or civilian members refer to the SA Army, and even the DoD, they talk about the SA Army. They don't distinguish between the SANDF and the SA Army. It's one thing. It's the SA Army. It must be able to do the following. So they've got a perceived capability of the Army. And if that is 100% of the current capability, that is indicated on this figure. And this will indicate over time. However, there are certain things that influence the current perceived capability of the SA Army. From loss of skills to limited budget allocations, all those type of things. To, in actual fact, bring us to an actual type of capability. And if we do not take that actual capability and maintain it and grow it, it will further, I'm sorry, the slide seems to have cut off, but it is available on the slide, it will cut off, or it will even shrink further more. The main challenge, however, is that the actual requirements that are needed continentally is much more than the SA Army has. So there's a lot of pressure on the SA Army to get involved in more and more and more type of activities. If we take that to the national responsibility that the SA Army has, even with Corona, it can even also grow out of proportion if we are not very careful in this regard. And then if we look at the regional capability, once again we must make sure that we are also not overstretched on the regional capability. So what is the challenge? Is the challenge may become that we become overstretched in the long run with regard to the current capabilities that we have. And that was clearly stated in the 09-10 report as well. What are the threats? I think what is important about the SA Army is people always think South Africa will have the defense force that it deserves. South Africa will have the SA Army that it deserves. So it is very important that we invest in it, that we build in it, that we make sure that it's combat ready and that we can achieve whatever goals we need to achieve with it. I think what is important is it takes time to build a capability like the SA Army. Very importantly, if the requirement arises and you do not have the capability, it may be too late to try and generate that capability. So if you've lost the capability, you cannot regenerate that within a few days or a few months. It takes you time to do it. Then, as I said, capabilities must be constantly maintained as you move into the future. And then, if no or limited capabilities exist, I think in the worst case scenario, it can invite opportunism from outside as well. What is very important about this, to my opinion, is if we look at the elements of power, being diplomatic, informational, military, economic, and social, these things must be in balance with one another. You cannot have a foreign policy striving towards this, but you do not have the other instruments of power backing up that type of approach as well. Notwithstanding all of this that I have said to you, I think if we look at the SA Army's achievement, firstly external operations, the SA Army provided a battalion plus to the DRC over the specific period, a battalion to Sudan Operation Cordai, and it concluded a 10-year-long deployment in Burundi over the given period. If we look at external training, we took part in the training at Central African Republic and the DRC in the different missions and we also presented different forces for these different countries as well. Then very importantly, if we look at internal operations, we partook in Operation Quelle during this specific phase. Maybe I should just say to you it was Operation Quelle that we partook in Operation Prosper, and we supported the SAPS in broad as well. Then supporting the training of foreign forces, this was to a limited extent, but we partook in Exercise Lighting Warrior with Singapore, where we aided them with training at the Combat Training Center. The same with Exercise African Thorn, where we aided the UK with their different training endeavors as well. If we look at the summary, social responsibilities, once again, I think what is important, we partook in Exercise Chariot, where we built three bridges in the Eastern Cape, once again as part and parcel of the National Department of Public Works, intention to upgrade and to make sure that things are in place in that environment. And then with regard to exercises, I would like to say to you that was it not for the SA Army, I'm almost sure that Exercise Golfino would not have taken place. We provided the bulk of the forces, we provided the planning capability being 4-3 Brigade, and I think this is an exercise of which we are very proud at this stage. And in actual fact, it put SADC BRIC at that stage on the maps for the first time to conduct a SADC exercise as well. So very proud of that achievement as well. If we look at Exercise Avoca, once again we exercised our major combat capabilities in this regard. Very importantly, once again we focus on the concept of first doing conventional training and then specializing into peacekeeping, peace enforcement, or peace enforcement, peacekeeping training thereafter. In general, we can say that we have also aided other countries, specifically the Namibian Army, in the training of the G2 guns that was provided to the Namibian Army. We are now in the phase where we are helping them out with the doctrine, and finally we will help them out with the establishment of their whole artillery school as well. So once again, I think we are quite well involved in the external environment as well. Honourable Chair, I think what is important is to look at how the SA Army does its planning. And if you do not understand how it does its planning, it is always difficult because the question is always is combat readiness. How combat ready are you? What are you doing? Now, the first thing that I would like to categorically state is that once we send forces on operations, they are combat ready. There may be one or two smaller challenges, for sure. That is how things work. But in broad, we provide a combat ready force that is given to CG Ops. Once CG Ops has these forces, they are trained and made mission ready. And once they are mission ready, are they then taken to the external environment and deployed to the specific country. If we look at the systems approach, we use the acronym POSTED FIT. PEACE, representing personnel, O, organization, sustainment, training, equipment, doctrine, facilities, information, and technology. Now, this is very important to us to measure ourselves against these elements as well. So, if we can summarize that, we say to ourselves, if you want to be combat ready, you must be combat ready across all of these aspects. That is in an ideal world. It will not always be there, but we are really striving to achieve it that way. If we then take this as an example, let's use the infantry as an example. If it has all those elements, it is combat ready. And that is what we try to achieve with the forces that we deploy during operations. However, in reality, there will always be one or two challenges that arise out of the fact that all the posted fit elements are not 100% up to scratch. If we look at the challenges posted fit wise, and this also links to what we have reported in the 09-10 report. If we look at personnel, once again, we have a challenge with the humane exit mechanism. Like HR is busy developing that. I think you have received reports in this regard. So it is important that we also have a humane exit mechanism where we can exit members that are no longer economically fit in the organization. And this also speaks to the whole depletion of the operating budget versus the HR budget. So that is very important to us as well. Currently, the Army stands at 59% HR budget versus its operating budget. Now, yes, this is challenging. The ideal way to go for the SA Army, to our opinion, is to say we must at least achieve a 55% of our spending on the HR budget, because that is the national or the international norm. Contrary to the Navy and the Air Force, the Army is human-centric. So we use a lot of people in the organization to achieve our objectives. The Navy and the Air Force use a lot of equipment and technology to obtain their specific objectives. If we look at the money available, they've limited the money available for MSD intakes, and the challenge with this is that you cannot feed your reserves and that you have limited money available even to rejuvenate your current CSS troops, the more regular force troops in the system as well. Then, we have also limited funds insofar as we cannot staff the social structure that we have. We have currently staffed 39,000 people, that is including the PSAP members. So, yes, that is what we are focusing on. We are working on the concept of boots on the ground, not necessarily at the first available. Then, if we look at critical skills loss, I think one of the things with regard to personnel is we cannot retain those members. But what I must also say to you is a lot of people say, how do you retain skills? And Admiral Poitevaart mentioned a few methods in order to retain scarce skills. But there's also Maslow's motivational hierarchy that says you start off with basic needs and then you live up to self-actualization on the top part of the triangle. So what the Army does, it tries to create capacity, it tries to employ its forces, it tries to make the system adventurous, it tries to make the system work for the members to be retained in the system as well. If we look at specific shortages that we encounter at this stage, more on the technical environment, the logistic environment, and the catering environment per se. And then, to our opinion, very importantly, and I've tried to indicate that with you with the opening of the initial slide, where we said we must guard against overutilization of the people and the SA Army as well. If the operational tempo becomes too high, we will definitely in future encounter social problems as well. If we look at the organization, the old organization that we have is based on a typical silo type of approach. We are not following the integrated approach which is required from us with regard to future warfare. So we, dysfunctional is maybe a very strong word here, but we need to change this organization instead of being a silo, to put it horizontally and to integrate this organization as well. And a lot has already been done in the SA Army in this regard. If we look at sustainment, I think what we are saying here is it will be very difficult to sustain all three of the sides of the triangle simultaneously at this stage. Yes, we will definitely be able to sustain our forces and our current operations and those type of things, but if you have to execute all of them simultaneously, it will be a challenge. And then, yes, for sure, stock levels are slowly but surely being eroded as we are moving along, so we must guard against that and we must make sure that those things are in place as well. If we look at training challenges, I think the main challenge, as indicated in the report as well, is the ammunition shortage that we have, and then limited vehicles. And we will once again refer to that a bit later, being the A, B, and C vehicles that we have certain challenges with. Then also lack of suitable training areas. Currently we have enough training areas, but if we want to move into the future domains, once again, we must look at these domains as well, and we must make sure that we obtain these type of environments. Yes, we have certain environments where we can train. We can send our forces for pre-deployment into certain countries even, if we want to go that far. But yes, there are capabilities. The ideal, however, would be to have most of these capabilities available internally as well. Then, very importantly, we said that we need to focus on future operations. I think we're doing a stern job at this specific stage with what we are doing. But if we look at the future, we must definitely also make sure that our doctrine is updated, that we adhere to what is required externally as well. Then, if we look at simulation, I think what is important is, if you are cash-strapped for money, one of the solutions is simulation. But the problem with simulation is, the initial investment in simulation is very high at the initial stages. So once you've got the simulation, training will be much cheaper in the future, but to get simulation on the ground in an integrated fashion is going to be a pricey type of exercise as well. However, if we look at the whole new acquiring process that we have, where we introduce new equipment and those type of things, they come with their simulation systems as they are introduced in the system. So yes, we are already addressing this issue to a great extent. Then knowledge is declining. I think that is so. However, if I say knowledge is declining, I think what is important is we are also picking up a lot of knowledge, specifically in the peacekeeping, peace enforcement type of environments by deploying in Africa as well. However, because we are not engaged in conventional type of operations and those type of things, for sure you are going to scale down on that as well in future, but the focus is currently on peacekeeping, peace enforcement type of environments. If we look at equipment, once again, old unserviceable, beyond economical repair and obsolete equipment, and specifically to maintain older equipment is a challenge as well, because it costs you a lot of money. Here we specifically refer to ABC and D vehicles, and then also to weapons in broad. And that is the whole system of, yes, we must make sure that the landward renewal program is once again started off as well. Here we focus on the landward renewal that must now come to fruition as well. If we look at doctrine and policy, also here you will see funds is a challenge to a certain extent, specifically to focus, to do R&D and those type of things on future type of environment. And then we are mainly focusing on maintaining what we currently have, specifically in the major combat operations. Once again, if you look at peacekeeping, peace enforcement, I think there is a good relationship with a lot of countries, with what is happening in the practical environment where we can upgrade our doctrine as well. If we look at facilities, I think the biggest challenge that we have is this whole story of dilapidated facilities. Specifically in the year under revision, the RAM programs were stopped. It had a major impact on the SA Army, and we had to allocate additional funds in the format of 20.4 million and I think 27. Something million to just from our side make sure that we maintain our facilities. And at this stage, the Department of Public Works is really slow, although I know there's good negotiations between the Secretary and the Department of Public Works, and with the new refurbishment programs, things are slowly but surely coming into place as well. Then available facilities are not sufficient. I think this is also something that we will have to address in future, but I think the priority now is to make sure that what we have is upgraded and is totally safe for occupation and those type of things as well. I think the main impact of this is there can be litigation against the department, and there can be some facilities that close in future as well if we do not look at that. As I said, I think what is important is that I think the negotiations are in place. The latest refurbishment program that we got shows specific priorities for the next 3 years from the Department of Public Works side, and I think if we stick to that program, we will definitely address the issues in future as well. If we look at information, and here it's the system, the technical system, I think what we need to do is we've got brilliant information systems, but all of them are not totally integrated. And once again, there are major initiatives now in the DoD to integrate these systems as well. Looking at technology, once again, to my opinion, we do have outdated technology, and it can lead to cumbersome execution of certain activities. So it is important that we focus on technology, that we have money, that we spend money on technology and the research and development for new technology. But there are other ways to overcome this as well. A good example is what the Army is currently doing. It is in a mutual investigation or research concept with the CSIR, where we are utilizing the CSIR to make good for certain requirements that we do not have at this stage. If we look at the focus areas, to summarize everything that we have said to you up until now, and I would really like us to focus on these elements as well. I think the Army is underfunded. We have said that to one another. That is very important. But the second thing that is vital to us is the whole story of people. If we address those two issues, we will definitely make good of the SOM. A lot of effort currently is going into the people issue, where we say, select the right people and place the right people in the right post. If you have good people, and even if you have certain challenges, they will still achieve the missions. So that's the only approach to make sure that we can achieve that. In summary, I would like to say the Army will constantly strive to achieve its operational obligations and its mandate. And yes, we have achieved what we were supposed to achieve. And we are highly proud of what we have achieved in the past. Furthermore, the Army is seriously investing in its people. Because all in the Army revolves around people. People is the most important thing in the Army. It's the soldier on the ground that makes the decision that influences the final outcome of that specific operation. And then, yes, I think we can do with additional funds in the SA Army as well. Chairman, that's a broad overview with regard to the SA Army. I do not know if there are any questions from your side.
Not in this particular moment. I know you've done a very good job as usual. I give honorable members, you'd understand that there would be questions that would have been in the annual report and combined with this. So it's not what both members have been trying to do was to inform and strengthen the information that we have in the annual report. So I'll allow it in that. I must say that not the first time I've gone and listened to the general. I know how good he is in his presentation. Dr. Mlange.
Thank you, General. Thank you very much. Thank you, Chairperson. To me, a government that cannot protect its people, its territory, is a useless government. Absolutely useless, and it need not exist or govern a country. People are not only important in the army, but in the whole country. First thing that comes into my mind is people must be satisfied in any country. A government which cannot satisfy its people is not fit to govern. We read in the media and we hear people talk and say, why should so much money be spent in equipping the army when there is no war? I don't subscribe to that kind of argument, Chairperson. Absolutely. I don't subscribe to it. Our army has got to be fully equipped at all times. Our army must always be ready at all times. Government must spend its resources properly. If we do not, among other things, acquire new equipment to be up to date with the other countries, we will find ourselves 10 years behind. 10 years behind in trying to cover up what other countries have already achieved. You know, we used to have here in Parliament General Fillon of the Freedom Front. I used to fully agree with him on that issue of the army always being kept fully equipped. Even if there is no war, even if there is no war during peacetime. And his argument also used to be, when I was talking of the army, I'm including the SANDF. I'm including the Navy, sorry, and the Air Force. Everything that has to do with security and the defense of the country. He used to say,
we will never catch up with other countries if we say we should not equip our army because there is no war. I subscribe to that. Comrades, at all times, I think we as members of the Portfolio Committee on Defense, make sure that the army is fully equipped. War or no war? Why should there be lack of sufficient training ground? Why should there be? Our country is so big. Huge areas belong to the states, unoccupied. Why can't the army use that for trading purposes? Why should there be lack of suitable training areas and equipment? It's unnecessary for that. Old equipment that has become expensive to service. Why should we? Why can't we replace that old equipment? Buy new equipment. Because servicing old equipment is uneconomical, very expensive for the government. So, I call my daughter, number five. No, I'm still looking at some of the points I want to raise, man. You know, it makes us angry, some of us. You know, to be told that there's lack of this, lack of that, and so on and so on. Anyway, for the time being, thank you very much.
So I understand what you're saying. I have you, Honorable Mlambo.
Okay, I'm coming. Thank you, Chairperson. And thank you to Brigadier General. Mine is on the issue of this old and unserviceable equipment that Mlambo is talking about. You know, it's funny, because here we're talking about serious kind of things, motor batteries, you know. That means maybe our artillery pieces that we have are 40 to 50 years old. And that cannot be correct. And what I don't understand, how do we then begin to train Namibia when we've got old kind of equipment like that? It sounds funny to me. And how much, General, do we spend in maintaining those kind of equipment? Because like Kutatum Langan is saying, you might find that if we buy new equipment, it will be less expensive than maintaining this old kind of equipment. I think that's very terrible for our armed forces. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want the clarity on this, on slide number 45, under organization. What does it mean, this based on the silo approach? If the presenter can give us a more elaborate on what it means. And the second question is on the challenges that the two members have already indicated, is on personnel and the facilities that are duplicated. So I just want to check with the admiral that in other presentation we do have a statistics on personnel. Now he is saying that there is a decline on knowledge and then there's an exit of, so we don't have the total of how many are there. And if it's the personnel is a challenge, how many are there and how many are going out from the system? And the last question, I just want to check what the clarity on the ramp
RAMP, what does it mean, and why is it, why are the funds stopped there? Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. And thanks so much, Brigadier General Cross. I think yours has been a very straightforward, honest presentation. On slide 31, the Army has perceived capability. Among other things that affect the capability of the Army, you cite culture. May you elaborate on that? Slide 57 on people, selection of the right people, and placing of those people in the right post. Whose responsibility is it? Lastly, I share Honorable Mlangeni's emotional sentiment that the Army must be equipped, must be budgeted for, must be looked after, well looked after. I'm simply repeating my request to you, Honorable Chair, that we get the plight of the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force from this air-conditioned boardroom or portfolio committee meeting room, eating snacks from time to time, and actually visualizing their problem without having first-hand knowledge and experience. So I'm simply renewing my request that surely sometimes we should just give ourselves ample time to go out there and see what these people are saying. Maybe we'll come being different people and we'll try for a different perspective. Surely I think we need inspection in loco. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the General for his very frank presentation. I must say, General, that your presentation read together with the annual report is of huge concern, because it's very difficult to draw any other conclusion than the fact that the South African Army is in deep trouble. Let me then put four questions to you. In your presentation, you on slide 46, you refer to sustainment, where you say that the South African Army at current funding levels cannot sustain combat operations, support to the people, and force preparation simultaneously. And in the annual report, it is also said that South Africa, I quote from page 49, Chair, of the annual report, the South African Army is on the verge of losing all these capabilities, and the capabilities referred to here are major combat operation capabilities. So my first question is, what major combat operation capabilities are we in danger of losing? The second part of your presentation, which is of deep concern, is the question of capital acquisition. On slide 50, you say that landward renewal is not coming to fruition. Most projects are on hold because of cost escalation. And again, on page 49 of the annual report, you say that because of this, the South African Army has now adopted a state of, and I quote, partial acquisition approach. Now, again, what projects have been put on hold, and what are the consequences of that? Because, of course, we see in the medium, in the adjusted appropriations, that more than R1 billion has been stripped out of capital acquisition in order to pay for compensation of employees. Those are the two first-order questions. Then two additional questions. On Operation Corona, Operation Corona, as we all know, is the border safeguarding operation. It is an operation which will be phased in over 4 years. My question to you, General, is could you explain why the decision was taken to phase that operation in? What are the constraints on deploying the South African Army onto the border for border safeguarding duties? Because it would seem to me that that operation needed to be phased in a lot quicker. But what are the constraints? Because it seems to me that the constraints go beyond the mere funding constraint. Finally, then on page 133 of the annual report, there's a rather disturbing reference, which I wonder if you could read. Oh, I wonder if you could expand upon. It reads as follows. 6 maintenance units have been fully migrated into the South African Army, but without staff and equipment. Theoretically, the South African Army Technical Service Corps capability has been enhanced, but in real terms, that is not the case, as these units have not been staffed or equipped for their task. Could you please expand on that and perhaps explain what the risk is to the maintenance of equipment in the South African Army? Thank you.
Honourable Mazir.
Thank you, Chairman. On slide 31, on personnel, you speak about loss of skills. And on page 48, you also talk about the decline of knowledge. Now, I want to know, because in most instances the threat to your personnel is as a result of the salary payments. Now, is this a recurring problem, or is it a problem which existed before the intervention of the minister? And faced with this challenge, when we were going through the report of the maritime, I noticed that there is a lot of training taking place, and a lot of intakes that are coming in for training, and if I'm not mistaken, it was a figure of 3,000 and a couple of hundred on training. Now, in the defense, I don't see any programs of training to deal with the areas that you are identifying, the decline of knowledge, and this loss of personnel. But also, I'm not sure if these areas you are identifying are the areas you are identifying before the salary adjustment of the intervention of the minister. I would seek clarity on that.
That's it,
yeah. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, General. Slide 52 on facilities. The facilities which are dated in the past. We had the military intelligence facilities which were going down, but now they are not identified in this problem. I wonder whether those facilities of military intelligence have been renovated now, because it is a terrible in the land. Thank you very much.
No member, you could just switch off your mic. You know, I know where you are, General. I mean, we have had long discussion about this type of issues. And then he's one of the drafters of the 2020 vision of the army itself. So it's key in policy making within the defense. That's why I was able to remain frank in how you present it. So you have kept that on. But also, you see, for me, it's important that you pull a little bit of background in terms of integration, of how much it has impacted on the army itself, you see. Because some of the issues that you are speaking to are fairly not new. I mean, these are issues that have been raised. And the impact of the armed strategy package, you see, in the way it got structured, how it has affected the army itself, you see. And the effect of peacekeeping missions, you would know for a matter of fact that that is not directed in terms of policy or in terms of decision by what happens within the army or within the defense. These are decisions made to influence what happens within the defense and what happens within the army itself. How much of that has influenced the type of situation that you're confronted with? But what I appreciate from members is also the type of support that you want to put behind the wheel and assist into achieving some of the things that they are raising. So for me, those are the crucial parts, that how does these things have effect, you see. Because also, you see, when you give me the question of the artillery and the years that of engagement and how long has this instrument have been coming along, you see, and that's why today are facing these type of challenges. It's not that they had happened only in 1994, but they have come on with quite a lot. A lot of changes have been taking place within that defense. I don't want you to be able to reflect on those things, so you could be able to assist us in contextualizing some of the challenges that are there, which doesn't, in a practical way, sometimes put the responsibility solely on the present ministry, but it's been problems and engagements within the defense that has come on for quite a longer time. But I know when we're crafting out 2020, the 2020 vision, these type of problems were already there before the 2004 administration came into place. So it's not quite like a new problem, new found issue, but it is a challenge within the SNDF, and we need to be able to deal with it. I'll give over to you, General, out of your experiences, to give us the context of how you have been moving. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Chairman. So I can start off with the first question with regard to training of the Namibians. Why do we do that? I think we must understand that in Africa, we follow the whole concept of a collective defense. We want to build the old SADC brick, or the now SADC standby force. We want to integrate these forces. We are co-signatures to the SADC pact and all those type of things. So yes, we are definitely going to contribute in the SADC environment to upgrading other countries' capabilities as well. Why did we get involved in the Namibian environment? So I cannot tell you. I do not know what the detail is in the background to why we got involved in Namibia. But what I know is that we provided them with old G2 guns that we phased out of our system, that we no longer use. So the ideal would be to not discard of them, but rather give them to somebody that can use them, and therefore the SA Army got involved in training the Namibian Defense Force after the equipment was handed to them, train them, utilize that equipment, write the doctrine, and get the schools, the artillery school on its feet. The second question was with regard to the silo approach. Ma'am, it is a difficult question. It's actually an excellent question that you are asking. If we look at future war,
we are no longer going to fight as an armor force or as an infantry force or as an artillery force or as the army on its own or the navy on its own. So how we were structured in the past and actually now at this stage, and we are in the process of changing that, is we have different formations that look after different capabilities. A good example is we have an armor formation, and in the armor formation you have all the armor capabilities neatly packed under that formation, and the armor formation manages the armor capability. The infantry also looks at the different infantry environments, being the motorized infantry, being the mechanized infantry, being the parachute infantry, once again all neatly packed up or packed in under the infantry formation, and they manage all the capabilities. Now just to give you an example, in the infantry you have 11 regular force units, you've got 24 reserve force units. In the armor you have about 4 or 5 units altogether, so there's a disparity in responsibility and width of command that you have to address as well. However, that's not the problem. The biggest problem is we believe in you train as you fight. That is vital. You must train now as you are going to fight tomorrow. And to do that, you cannot have the armor separate from the infantry. What we want is we want those forces integrated already. So what the army wants to do is they want to reorganize into, for argument's sake, a brigade type of structure, where you will have a brigade, where it will have its inherent infantry, armor, artillery, its workshops, its logistical units, its maintenance units, its signal units, all those type of things. And once you take that organization, you go exercise it. They exercise as an integrated whole. So where we have a silo approach like that in the past, where you had the infantry, armor, artillery, we want to turn it on its head to integrate it, where you have a brigade with all the different capabilities integrated into that specific capability. So that's the whole story with regard to a silo approach. The third question, I must honestly say, I distrust my own writing. I have here personnel facilities. How many is going out of the system? I assume it was with regard to the personnel. Maybe this question will also address one or two of the questions that come later as well. What we have seen is that in the Army, there is a natural attrition rate of more or less 1,500 people annually. So that's the annual attrition rate. With the enhancing of the salary packages and those type of things, we see that that rate is coming down more or less to 1,400 people. And I assume that in future that will even come down further. But salaries are not the only thing that keep people in or let people go out. I think there's a lot of things that make a difference. You know, it's always interesting for me, and sorry that I'm using the Air Force example now, but if you have a pilot, he will stay in the Air Force as long as he can fly, because that is why he is here. So it is important that you stimulate these guys, and that's why I refer to Maslow's hierarchy as well. He wants to operate in the self-actualization block at the top of that triangle. He wants to live. He wants to do what he's there for. He wants to wear the wings. If you are a submariner, you want to wear the watch, you want to wear the jacket, but you want to go to sea to do what you are supposed to do. So I think if we look at why people leave, yes, material aspects are important as well on the outside. A good example is, if you look at the technical services corps that we have, we keep on training technical services members, and yes, we keep on losing a certain amount of technical service members to the outside world. And the long and the short is just, they are paid much, much more. You know, a final thing, and I know we are a bit on the philosophizing side of things, is in the past, people came to the military for the adventure type of things that they experienced within the military. Today you don't have to do or come to the military any longer. You can join whatever company you want to join. If you are a technical service specialist, you join this company, you tour throughout Africa, you fix these vehicles, all those type of things. So the same adventure can be provided on other elements as well. But
Are we going to lose it? Is it a natural phenomenon? I think it's a natural. It's been a natural phenomenon since we started off. I can remember in the old days we lost members to the outside world. But different measures are being put in place, as was explained by Admiral Teutoberg, from the HR side. A lot of incentives are put in place, better salaries, and yes, we are definitely seeing a decline in losing members at this stage. With regard to the RAMP program, the RAMP program was a program that was instituted by the Department of Public Works, and it was a refurbishment program to fix the facilities of the different departments. Once again, I'm unsure why the RAMP program was stopped in 2019, but in the middle of 2019, the Department of Public Works said, we are going to stop it, and we are not only going to fix this, the things that needs fixing. We are going to stand back and we are going to look at a broader concept of refurbishing, to start off from A to Z and fix everything. So the approach with regard to the RAMP, I assume, was to stop only maintaining buildings and seeing it filter and filter out further down the line. If you fix this, another thing breaks. So the idea was to look at the total concept to say, okay, once we tackle a building, let's refurbish it properly from the beginning, fix it, get it in place, and then hand it over to the specific department. And then the department only has to spend limited funds in order to maintain those facilities. Then with regard to perceived capabilities, if we look at perceived capabilities, there's a lot of things, once again, that can influence. But a good example, you asked culture. Now, I will always ask myself, what is culture? Now, to my opinion and my definition of culture, because that is important to us, is things like, what's the language that you speak? What religion do you practice? Etc., etc. So, one of the things that can impede us with regard to perceived capabilities is a good example of language. If you take the fact, even myself is speaking in my second language at this specific stage, the higher the pressure in an operational type of environment, the less comfortable you are in speaking in your second language, the higher the stress on that environment and those type of things, and yes, that can impede operational results in the long run. So those are typical the things that can influence us as we move along and as we execute operations as well. Just to give you an example, and that's not a good example because it's not very applicable to South Africa as well. I can remember with the Desert Storm, one of the biggest challenges that they had is to adhere to the different holidays of the different religions. And they could not attack on this day because this was a holiday for this religion. They could not attack on that day because this was a holiday for that religion. Luckily, we are not there at this stage, but those type of things can influence perceived capability as well. Then you asked a very important question of who is the responsible to select the right person and to place the right person in the right post? So, only ourselves. We do it. The generals. If I say the generals, let's say the management of organization, because there's different levels of management. For argument's sake, currently in the infantry formation, the infantry formation commander is responsible for placement of personnel up until the rank of majors and lieutenant colonels. Once it moves higher than that, it moves to a next level. So the people of the SANF, the people of the SA Army, the senior leadership of the SA Army determines who goes into what post. And once again, you know, what is important to me is that we really focus on effect, on efficiency, on capability. That is crucial. You can have the best person in strategy, but if you take him and you place him in a tactical type of post, he's not going to mean anything to you. No, he's going to do his work. It's probably his attitude is right and all those type of things. He's going to do his work. But you want that specific guy that excels in his specific environment. And therefore, it is crucial to say, I'm going to assess my people, I'm going out of the assessment, I'm going to select the best people, and I'm going to take those selected people, and I'm going to place them in specific posts according to the job profile that was written for that specific post as such.
So that is very important. But I think, I say to you that, to my opinion, you know, you can have the worst equipment, you can have no structures, you can have no money. But if you have good people, you can still make it work. You can still make it work. I once did a study on the Zimbabweans and their intervention in the Great Lakes environment. And once I looked at the detail of the logistical systems that they had and those type of things, now I'm over-exaggerating now, is they had limited logistics to keep them going. But why did they go? And the question is people and leadership. If you've got good people, the right people in the right places, you've got good leadership in place, and yes, this will carry the organization into the future as well.
And determination.
For sure. If you've got a good person, he's determined, he's got zest, he's got zeal, he wants to go, he knows what his objectives is, and he will go at all costs to achieve his specific objectives. That is true. We spoke about sustainment, and we said we will.
Before he goes to sustainment, Chairperson, I'm just concerned about the capabilities, you know, the type of capabilities that has been placed on hold. The project, the might be sensitive. Is there no way that we can handle it without on a public terrain like this? I was saying on the capabilities and the project, shouldn't we deal with it differently than saying it in the public arena?
I think I specifically would prefer that we do not discuss it in detail, but I will give you a broad answer on that. But I think we must deal on that issue separately now, I suggest. What I would like to say with regard to sustainment, I think it is very important to say that the Army has got two responsibilities with regard to sustainment. It's got a sustainment responsibility with regard to force preparation, so it must ensure that it can do force preparation. That is vital because we provide combat-ready forces to siege ops, as I explained just now. So firstly, we must have enough sustainment in place to do that. The second part is, once these forces are deployed, the generic sustainment is run by siege ops, the typical things like rations and fuel and those type of things. However, there are Army unique type of equipment that the Army is responsible to maintain as well. And therefore, it is important that we also make sure that we adhere to that responsibility. If we look at sustainment, therefore, is yes, we do not have all the funds that we require, but I think we are still providing 100% combat ready forces, and we are sustaining our forces definitely in the operations as well. With regard to the loss of the major combat operations capability, I think the Acting Secretary of Defense has ruled on that. I would like us, if at all possible, to discuss that in a closed session, if at all possible. Through the chair, please. Then with regard to the whole story of capital acquisition, the question was with regard to landlord renewal and the fact that it is on hold because of cost and those type of activities. The SA Army has communicated its requirement with regard to capital acquisition. It's done so on numerous occasions. However, we must not forget there's more or less 40 projects that have run up until now, of which 17 is in the concept phase, 17 is in the interim phase, and 17 is concluded already. And once again, I would not like to allude to the detail of these projects. But there is a lot of things that are already happening as well. However, there are major things that we also need to address. We spoke about the shortage and the challenges with regard to A, B, and C vehicles. So,
the whole story of operational vehicles definitely needs some assistance. So we need to address these capabilities as well. So if we look at capital acquisition, I think the Army has not received additional funds yet in this environment to say, here is the additional funds, here is the, we have been registered as a priority for funding. We are waiting for this funding. Once we know what the funding is, then we can once again reprioritize to say, this is what we really need to achieve. However, as I have said, we do manage certain projects as well, and certain things are in the phasing out as well. There was also a link to funds taken by the minister in this regard. Now, if we look at the funds that are spent in this environment, it's mainly Folio 2 funds that can roll over from one year to another year. And how I currently understand it is that these are the funds that are mainly on loan, and that these funds will be put back into the capital acquisition program at a later stage, and that we will then have the capacity to spend it. Because some of these funds can also not be spent because of a lot of other reasons, like industry capacity and all of those type of things as well.
Interjection there. I think CFO's environment can put more detail onto that one.
You see, I was observing that the general seems not to want to be disturbed, so I thought I was going to give him a chance that he finishes his presentation, and I would really appreciate you to give him that opportunity. He is quite fairly aware that you must not go into other details that has got some where you can't, general, don't, even on the issues of personnel. I mean, I know that HR Mamuledwaba is quite willing to assist into those type of questions. So don't exhaust yourself in areas where you are not competent. I'm quite fairly knowledgeable of how the institution is working. So we'll give each other the opportunity.
Thank you, Chair.
And where you see some of the financial matters, besides the CFO, is part of your collective is here to assist you to find the answers there.
Thank you, sir. So the last thing that Mr. Mania asked was with regard to the partial acquisition, and where certain projects were put on hold and where it was actually phased in. I think what is important is, if you do not have enough funds available, you cannot spread the butter so thin that you have nothing left in any type of project. So what we said, and there are certain major projects, that if you institute that project to the full, you're going to use all the funds that are available for capital acquisition only for that specific project. So instead of taking that project because of the fund limitation, we say, let's do it because we require that equipment, but instead of buying, for argument's sake, 5 battalions, we will only buy 2 battalions this year, and in 2 years' time, another 2 battalions, so we will phase it. There's also definite advantages in such an approach as well. Because if you buy everything simultaneously in 10, 20, 30 years, depending on the equipment, you have to replace all of that equipment simultaneously. So a phased approach is much better to follow where you replace equipment as we progress. Then with regard to Corona, Mr. Mania, I must honestly say to you, I do not have the detailed answers that you have answered or asked in this regard. All I would like to say to you is what happened between the South African Police Force and the South African National Defence Force and the arrangements and why it is a phased approach, I'm not quite sure of. And most probably if CG Ops presents their presentation, maybe that will be more applicable to them to answer that specific aspect. But I must also say to you, what is important to us in the Army is also that we build capacity and capability. And I said to you, the Army is not like a light switch that you can switch on, now you have the capability, and you switch it off, and then the capability is gone. So we are also following a phased approach. A lot of things that are happening typically is the upgrade of the bases that are taking place. Once the bases are upgraded, then the Army can move into that base and from there on maintain those type of things. If we look at Corona, there's a definite plan to upscale the deployments. And I can once again, I would not like in this open forum to say to you what the company allocations are, but I can give it to you in years the amount of companies that are planned for up until 1450. So there's a definite and a dramatic escalation of deploying companies on the different borders. The final thing that I would like to say to you, this is also coupled to threat. If I say threat, I would like to put it in inverted commas. So for sure, we are going to deploy, and you know already that we're on the Zimbabwean border, and we are mainly at this stage on the Mozambican border. And I think it's no secret that we have two companies north and that we have two companies east at this specific stage. So, but yes, there is a plan to increase it. What the reasons were for the phased approach and those type of things, I cannot give you a quality answer on that. Then there was a question on the six maintenance units that were integrated with health equipment and staff. So that's true. It's a fact. We received those units. It is mainly second-line maintenance units and workshop type of units. So it does not have that big an implication on us. What happened with these units, they were in the army in the past. Then they migrated to chief logistics at level 2. And then the decision was made that these capabilities must once again come back to the army. Once again, if you look at the system of maintenance and the workshop system, the technical services system, you have a first-line system, which is the army's responsibility, who has always been the army's responsibility, and that's your LWTs and your maintenance units and those type of things. Then there's a second line that supports the first line, and these are mainly the second-line units that we are talking about now. Now, these units are vital once you conduct major combat type of operations. But in the phase that we find ourselves in now, they are not that crucial. So, in actual fact, we have enough time to build that capacity as well. With regards to the six maintenance units. Then there was the question with regard to the loss of skills and the declining of knowledge. Certain decisions were made in the past. For argument's sake, just to give an example on these decisions, it was said that we will outsource a lot of capabilities to the private environment. A good example of that is we would have outsourced messes because it's not part and parcel of core business. But it is a good principle from a private perspective to stick to core business. However, once we started deploying our forces in Africa, we saw that now we have a private company running a mess, and now you want to deploy these private members and or civilian members, and they say, sorry, I'm not going to deploy in Africa. So what I'm trying to say to you is there were major challenges with this. So what happened in the army, as an example, is we took back a lot of those things that we initially outsourced, and we said, give us back our own capability so that we have freedom of action once we need to act. So that is very important. So what happened? We lost a lot of skills in the past with this outsourcing thing. Because we outsourced our technical services capability, these guys went to the private sector, they got jobs, and they are well paid, etc. Now we want to recreate this capability. And that is not so easy, because you are not going to take a guy who works for Telma and you say to him, he's earning this salary, come back to the SA Army, you're going to earn this salary, as an example. So now, once again, we have to grow our own capability. But just to give you an example of what has been done in this regard, to use the TIFIS as an example, we are training our own technical people at this stage to a great extent. Then we are also looking at, and we are investigating with industry, because they also need to qualify their apprentices at certain stages. So there's an investigation to most probably look at taking those apprentices into the army, and once they have to do their practicals, that we pay them as a reserve force member in the SA Army, and he does it in the SA Army, and he works on the SA Army vehicle to uplift the serviceability and availability of A, B, C, and D vehicles. So, yes, we have lost a lot of capability skills. We are still going to lose certain skills. As I said to you, if you look at technical capabilities, for sure we are going to lose them. But there are certain plans in place from the HR side, from the remuneration side, to keep those members in the system as well. Then there was a question with regard to the facilities of military intelligence. So I honestly do not know. Maybe from the SecDef side they will be able to address it, but I think Defense Intelligence will be the people that can give you a good answer and a quality answer on that, because I'm not knowledgeable with regard to that environment. There's a lot of, to come back to the question that the chairman asked, and he asked what was the impact of different things on the combat readiness of the SA Army. How does it impact on the SA Army? Well, I think the biggest challenge that we had at a certain stage, and even today, is if you speak to certain people, and if you look at future strategy and those type of things, you ask people, and the question was asked by one of the honorable members as well, when it was said, the question usually asked is, why do we need a capable and able army? Why do we need to maintain this at cost? Now, there's also a saying in worldwide that says, no poor country can wage war. We must take note, if we want the army, we will have to invest money in this army. And once again, I would go back to what was said, is we are going to have the army that we are willing to pay for. And the army will provide you with its best ability and the best bang for the buck that it can. That I can vouch for. We will try our best to provide it to you. But if you've got 10 rand, you will have a 10 rand package. If you've got 1 million rand, you will have 1 million rand package. If we look at the strategic packages, the history of the strategic packages, to make a long story short, was it was decided that the Navy as well as the Air Force would receive preference with regard to the strategic defense packages, and that the Army had to wait a while for its turn to come. However, I think what is important now is the effect of that is the fact that you sit with equipment and we sit with equipment that is very old, and once this equipment is very old, you must understand that these trucks, as an example, drive in the felt, they take heavy hammerage, all those type of things. So the challenge that you have is, if you have a vehicle like the Sommel that is 34 years of age, that's been operating in the felt, it is difficult to maintain these things. And therefore, it is of vital importance that, to my opinion, to make sure that we invest in the strategic defense packages, that we inculcate them into the system, and that we manage these things. They are going to be much cheaper, and their technology to handle the hammering and those type of things are much better. So their serviceability and availability will be much better in future as well. Then I also would like to say to you, when we started off with the SA Army after 94, everybody saw this whole blue skies type of approach. Everything was going to go well, and we were not going to have any challenges. There was no corona reporting back to the borders. There was no peacekeeping operations, all those type of things on the cards. The minute you start sending your forces externally, we spoke about ammunition that is a challenge for the SA Army. To give you an example, we send ammunition to the DRC. They are packed in containers. It rains. It's humid. That ammunition starts rusting. If you do not utilize that ammunition, it starts rusting. It's been declassified as a category D ammunition, and we have to send it back and replace that type of ammunition as well. But if you use your forces operationally, that hemorrhage that those or that specific equipment take is much larger. A good example is, we deploy now in desert areas. Our weapons and systems were not specifically developed for desert areas. We are deploying in wet tropical regions. Our equipment per se was not developed. Yes, we can operate in it. We can operate in it because we've got good vehicles. That is so. But it's not optimal for that specific environment, and therefore the equipment takes a much larger amperage as such. With all this said and done, I think what is important for the SA Army is the following. And I sometimes get frightened with the next expression, which says the Army has got a can-do approach. We can do. Give us the order and we will go. Sometimes there are much larger challenges, sometimes lesser challenges. But we will do what we are supposed to do. And what are we supposed to do? We are only supposed to do one thing. And that is, we must serve the government of the day. And that is what we will do now and in future as well. But to do that, from our side, we stand with outstretched hand to say, help us. Take our hand, help us to be able to do this. Because we need your support as well. Honorable Chairman, thank you very much.
I'll ask Dr. Zawada to come in on the skills. A lot of skills. Thank you, Excellent Faculty. Honorable Chairperson, honorable members, a week ago we came here, we did a detailed presentation on the loss of scarce skills as well as the exit mechanism. We showed the table and we categorized the different skills that are exiting within the DoD. And we were asked a question to also detail that in terms of race and gender for the three consecutive financial years. We did prepare the presentation for the three consecutive years, detailing it in terms of race and gender. And for the Army, mainly they are losing technical skills. And technical skills because in the past, allowances were paid only to the Navy as well as to the Air Force. With the technical practitioners within the within the South African Army, the mandating committee had just approved their allowance to be paid, and we are in the process of paying those technical allowances. With the increases that the minister has announced last year, it has really benefited because we have seen a cap and the decrease in the brain drain that we are having in terms of the loss of skills within the DoD. And I think with the implementation of the technical allowance that we are currently implementing, and we also indicated that because some of the OSDs that are in the public service, they do not specifically address the specific needs of the DoD because the department is very unique as compared to other departments. We are working with National Treasury and the Department of Public Service and Administration to come up with a specific OSD that is suitable for the Department of Defense, which we are hoping by April next year we will be able to implement this specific OSD that will address all the critical missions that are there in the Department of Defense. That's the first question on the loss of skills. And then with regard to the aging people who are within the South African Army, in 1994 we integrated seven different forces. And for one to be able to leave an organization with a decent pension, you have to have served at least 10 years or more. And unfortunately, the different problems that the Department of Defense is suffering from are the same problems that the entire society of our country is suffering from. So we do not want to throw people outside in the street when we know that if they leave the department, they will not have sufficient funds to live on. They will be a burden of the state. So we have kept those people to ensure that they work until their retirement age, to make sure that they live with a sizable pension. And the other thing is that to come up with a unique retirement pension for the Department of Defense, we will have to divide ourselves from the pension fund that we currently have, because as the state we only have one pension fund, and that pension fund has its rules that determines the amount of money you can withdraw from the pension when you leave an organization. So with the members who are aging, I'm hoping that the NSS pension that was just approved by cabinet is also going to assist to be able to make a number of members be able to retire with a decent pension when they leave the organization. And in that way, it will enable us to also rejuvenate. We did present last week on a detailed presentation of the military skills development and how it is assisting us to rejuvenate. And we also did indicate last week that despite the different exit mechanisms that we have, it is still not enough to make sure that aging people do leave our system fast enough to be able to rejuvenate the system. But we are positively working to ensure that we achieve all these objectives. And with the minister that we have now, I think we will be able to achieve the type of objectives that we have put in place. Thank you.
Chair, yes. Actually, with your indulgence, during the presentation by Admiral Twitterberg, the question was also asked whether the underfunding issue has been resolved, and if not, what should we do? I think that was the question posed by the Honourable Member. And then adding to that, also the consequences of the underfunding and how it relates. In the first instance, the department follows the normal budget process as any other government department. However, defence is one of those departments that operates in the background, so we are doing very good work, but if we come to priorities for government, that's not necessarily one of the most outstanding one. It's not like alleviating poverty as such, although we do contribute to that. So consequently, we also vie for additional funds. All that taken into consideration, the department was successful to some extent. However, in the year under review, 9-10, the department was challenged further with a reduction in its budget with 422 million due to efficiency savings that we had to enforce. That over and above the fact that we didn't really get what we requested. If one goes back into the history, all the presentations made to council year on year indicated our submissions to the medium-term expenditure committee, the funds that requested or required, and then also what we actually received. And there's a significant discrepancy between the two. While, as already General Drost indicated, that we acknowledge that defense will never get all the funds required, we still get maybe 5% of what we need. And it definitely impacts negatively on the department. But even more so, one should not only look on the impact on the department, but on the defense industry as well. Because most of that funds are going to the defense industry. If we talk about the rejuvenation of landward defense, the equipment that we buy, that comes from the defense industry. We don't have our own manufacturing plants and stuff like that. So it impacts much more than just on the Department of Defense. The 1 billion rand that we refer to in terms of funding the salary dispensation, That came primarily from the fact that the A400M contract was cancelled, so there were money that was available. We engaged the National Treasury requesting for that fund, and it was approved as part of the adjustments amendment process. And then the remaining funds of 413 million, if my memory serves me correct, was borrowed as indicated by General Dross for this year due to projects and a number of related issues like the industry that cannot provide the equipment in terms of our timescales. That money has now been moved to the right. The expenditure has been moved to the right. And that is how we managed to address that issue. Thank you.
Chairperson, there are two questions. One on Operation Corona, and the other one on defense intelligence facilities that we think were not fully answered. But we are of the opinion that we can provide written responses. However, would need assistance from the chair and perhaps members who ask the questions, just perhaps to pen them out so that we respond correctly to them. And then we also will get your guidance as to how we deal with the two questions I think we left out that pertains to the capabilities and the projects. The guidance will come from you.
We said we'll always look at questions that has impact on the annual report. And if it goes beyond that, we quite fairly aware the portfolio committee, that the Joint Standing Committee is one of the areas that would follow up the nature of those type of questions when they can't be answered at the public level. Although I'm being told is that we do, only through the approval of the speaker, would we be able to go into confidentiality. Those are internal matters of how we operate, but in essence, I think you handled most of the questions. And in extension, we'll ask the Joint Standing Committee to assist into providing those answers. That could not be answers that have got a little bit of sensitivity. Is there any other question from the honourable members that you'd want to inquire about that keeps within the spirit of the annual report? As I said, you have to bring it back into the annual report in the way the human resource questions that have been answered. If there's no questions, honourable members, it clearly says that we need to go to court. Well, this was an agreement, as you remember, that in the portfolio committee, where we've agreed jointly that we'll look into the specifics in the annual report of issues that had impact in the way the annual report was presented. We still want to thank the secretary for being able to keep to that decision. I think they're doing very well. But also the different aspects to that is the integrated approach that you have taken in how you are dealing with these different matters. So tomorrow we're meeting again at 9 o'clock. I still want to apologize for not being able to make it at 9. We're meeting in room M315 on the third floor in Max Building. And then we have the Air Defense and Military Health Support Program. And that will be, come tomorrow, that will be the end of our program from our side. So these are the two sectors that we're going to be addressing tomorrow, and then beyond that, I'm clear we'll see each other next year when the parliamentary processes are starting. That's what we'll be doing then tomorrow. But let me thank everybody in different ways in how we've handled different aspects of the confrontation. As usual, you have not disappointed me, and rely on the strength of the portfolio committee. As you could hear how they have expressed themselves, be very clear. They will always try to give you the support. Admiral, we are not forgotten, as usual. But we do think that we'll always be behind you, and this effort is really to make that so that you could be able to see and expose our members to that. Honorable members, we'll see each other tomorrow at 9 o'clock. Thank you.